As I said, the king has become aware of a good deed, a good turn that Mordecai has done for him in thwarting a plot against the king. And so upon learning that, he looks out the window, and who does he see but Haman? And tell Haman to come here. I've got a question for him. And Haman comes in and he says, Haman, I would like to do some honor to someone that has done me a favor. And so what would you suggest? And what does Haman suggest that the king do for this man he wants to show honor to? Yeah. Can you just imagine as he's saying that, he put him on the king's horse and he imagines himself on the king's horse. And deck him out with fancy attire, and he imagines himself with this arrayed in the king's finest, and have someone proclaim honor. You just imagine his name being proclaimed through the streets, and it's like he's salivating at the opportunity, and he doesn't get to salivate long because the king says, that sounds great. Mordecai's the man, and I want you to be the one to do the honor. And I mean, it's a scene that, you know, it's too good to be true. It's a scene that can only be scripted. Who has scripted this scene? God. Yeah, that's the point. I mean, as you're going through here, there's just too many, like, well, just that works out too nicely. And I think here's just another one of those occasions. It just falls right into place. Kevin? Right. Right. The swing of I'm about to have victory to my victory is about to be increased to, oh no, it is going to be literally the very opposite of what I had in mind. It couldn't be further from what Haman had hoped. So he does put Mordecai into the exact position that he had hoped to be in. He ends up being the one who walks before him proclaiming honor to Mordecai as opposed to some other noble proclaiming honor to Haman. He gets done with this, and what kind of mood is he in? Yeah, we might say his countenance has fallen. He is certainly not where he was at the beginning of the day, and he goes home and he tells his family what's happened. And what does his family say? Yeah, do what? Yeah, your trajectory has just changed radically, and it's not going to change. I mean, that's what they realize. It's over. This man is a Jew. This is the very one. One of the people that you proclaimed vengeance against, it's turned around, it's against your favor, and you are not going to survive this. And so there's just no encouragement. I mean, you know, you might expect that, you know, him to come in and then be like, look, it's fine, it's just an isolated, no, they're like, nope, this is exactly what it looks like. It's as bad as it seems. So, almost on the heels of this, certainly in the text on the heels of this, he's getting that bad news and he's getting the further discouragement from his family. And then somebody walks in and says, the king would like to see you. Whew. Now, the previous occasion where he's come before the king, and we've kind of skipped over that, what has been his idea walking into the previous occasion with Esther and the king? Yeah. Yeah. My stock's going up. The queen loves me. I mean, it's just, could it get any better? Now, all of a sudden, those same words, the king would like to see you, lump in the throat, you know, butterflies in the stomach. So he comes in and not nearly as hopeful as he had before. And then what happens this time? What does Esther say? Yes. Right, she exposes what's just happened. The king goes out, and Haman throws himself at the queen. Just tries to throw himself at her mercy. The king comes back in and sees that, and it is over. And what happens to Haman? Yeah, the considerable irony of all, right? There's a lot of irony already in how the tables turned with him and Mordecai. The greater irony of being the one to construct your own form of torturous death. Kevin? Yeah, right. Right, just throw that in. Again, orchestration. It's scripted. I mean, this is like a novel, the way things fall into place. Have you ever read a novel and when you get to the end of it, go, oh, well, that just wrapped up in a nice, neat package. I mean, the author's just, that would never happen in real life. That's sort of how you feel here. And I think you're supposed to feel that way. Like, this is just all too convenient. Because the hand is there. The providence of God is all through this book. And so here, being put up onto his own plot against Haman, or against Mordecai's turn back around on him. Well, the danger is not over yet. First of all, what happens to Haman's property? Yeah, it goes to Esther, who hands it over to Mordecai and puts him in charge of it. And so, again, the tables continue to turn in the opposite direction of what they were. But now what Esther wants is for the king to revoke the edict that has been made on behalf of Haman. And what is the king's response to that? Yeah, we're already familiar with this from the story of Daniel and the lion's den, aren't we? The law is, if the king has put a stamp of approval on something, it can't be reversed like that. But there can be mitigating legislation, right? Maybe we can't take away that law, but we can make another law that makes that one have less teeth in it. We do that a lot in our country, where there are things that we can't reverse or not easily reverse. And so instead of reversing it, we just make more legislation. And that's why, you know, a lot of people wonder why we have so many laws. Well, that's why. Because it's a lot easier just to make a new law than to take away an old law. So that's what they do. He basically hands over his signet ring. He hands over the scribes and says, figure out a way. You know, and he gives her a blank check. Whatever you need to try to save your people, it's at your disposal. And so what ends up being the means by which they're going to counteract this edict, this law? Okay, well, did they not have that opportunity before? I mean, let's go back just a minute. What exactly has been said? What did Haman ask for, and what was he granted? Do what? All right. It was the destruction of the Jews. It's sort of permission to go against the Jews. All right. What in the kingdom, the empire of the Medo-Persians, there's lots of different people, and the Jews have a lot of enemies. And what's happened is the sort of peace has been pulled back, the protection has been pulled back from the Jews. And now what's happened is the Jews have been given affirmative authority and encouragement to defend themselves. But not only defend themselves, what could they do to anybody who came against them? They could wipe them out and plunder. They could destroy any forces that came against them with no repercussions from the king. So now who's going to be excited to go against the Jews? Well, not near as excited as they were before. Yeah. Add to that the queen. The king's favored queen is a Jew. And his top advisor now is a Jew. And who wants to go against the Jews now? And so you see, at first glance, just reading through, you're like, well, all he told them is they could fight back. It's more than that. It's more just than that they could fight back. It's what he did is allow a word to be sent out in such a way that would just remove all motivation. To where you don't want to do this. It's not worth the cost, the potential cost in numerous ways. It's a clever answer, we might say. All right. Any other thoughts on Esther before we come back here to, right. Yeah. And you see, the Jews rejoicing. You see, well, incidentally, it said then in verse 32, the command of Esther established these customs for Purim, and it was written in the book. This is the basis of the Feast of Purim that's still celebrated to this day by Orthodox Jews. And you see Mordecai, second only, it says, to King Ahasuerus and great among the Jews, who sought the good of his people and the one who spoke for the welfare of his whole nation. And so you see, again, not only are the Jews not wiped out, but it turns entirely in the other direction until they are an influence in the other direction. They're about to be gone, And the idea, through providence, God completely turns that on its head and moves it in the opposite direction. Any other thoughts on that? Right. Yeah, a great deal. And I really do appreciate, Brad and I were talking about that proverb that God controls the heart of the king. How does he do that here? Not through overriding the king's will, but through the circumstances around that king, their opportunities. And those opportunities put the king in a place to where he is much more persuaded in the direction of God's people than he would be otherwise. All right. All of that's going on, and I think that there's a value to that story in seeing that God is taking care of his people, not only through the people that returned to build the temple, but also that the people who stayed back, God has usage for them as well. And so he's taking care of his remnant, both the returned remnant and the remnant that remains in captivity. He is continuing to watch over them, and I think that is evidence in the story of Esther. We come back to the focus on the return, because that story takes place in the middle of these two returns, the first one with Jeshua and Zerubbabel, and now we come to the return of Ezra, which, of course, is recorded in the book of Ezra, but Ezra, as a character, does not appear in the book by his name until chapter 7. Up till this point, Ezra is writing history that he is not a part of, right? And he's using documents. He even tells us some of where he gets the documents, and he compiles all that information. And then, starting in chapter 7, then he begins to record his own history, his own journey back to Jerusalem. And so in chapter 7, he begins by telling us what his lineage is and what his occupation is. And so what is his lineage of particular importance to us? Do what? Yeah. Yeah, he's a priest. That's his occupation. And of the direct lineage of Aaron through his son Eleazar. And so what does that make him have a right to be? High priest. And so... he is particularly equipped, at least genealogically, to do the work that he's about to do, to go back and to restore the worship. And so it lays it out there for us like that at the beginning. Now, beginning in verse 10, it says, Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord and to practice it and to teach his statutes and ordinances to Israel. So he's going to go back. The three returns... rebuild the temple, reinstitute worship. That's what we're going to do now. And then rebuild the walls. And so what he wants to do is go teach his people the law, I think, more carefully than it's been done up to this point. And more fervently, maybe, than it's been done up to this point. And so that's the task that he set about doing. And how does the king feel about that task? I think they wanted the gods on their behalf, and I think that they want the peoples on their behalf. And imagine after he does this for Jerusalem, then somebody comes up to Jerusalem and says, hey, we're going to rebel against the king. How likely do you think in the midst of this, they're going to be like, yeah, they're going to be like, well, we want no part of that. They're going to be like Mordecai. We're going to tell him that you're coming against him. And so, you know, even if some of the groups begin to rebel, on the whole, what he has done is created a network where it's going to be really hard to get a coalition of people who hate somebody who's treating the groups like this. The only thing they may want their independence, but as far as what Ezra wants and what the people of Jerusalem want, they've got what they want in this permission, not only permission, but also support, as we'll see. So what kind of support does the king give? So, I mean, just go down through what all, first of all, they're being given supplies from their countrymen, right? Just like Jeshua and Zerubbabel were, collections have been taken again, and those are handed over to the people. They're told whatever they need above and beyond that from the king's treasury. And then when they get down there, what other provisions are going to be theirs when they get there? There's several things. If you're a temple worker, no more taxes. Well, that's pretty big. What else? Right? And also the taxes that are collected in that area, that they're to take a portion of that. And they're to have, and he lists off that they're supposed to have, you know, wine, and they're supposed to have animals, they're supposed to have salt without measure. You know, whatever you need. Just make sure your God's happy. And petition him on my behalf. You know, it's basically, you get what you need to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish. It is not a blank check, but it is pretty close. It's whatever you need to get this done, I'm on your side and I'm here to support you. Not just that, but of course the letter itself. I mean, walking around with a letter of the king of Persia is no small thing. That would keep a lot of people away who might get in your way of just holding that up. You don't want that guy on your bad side, or you don't want to be on his bad side. So, all of those provisions are made available to him. And as far as how many people, what's the number that we're given here? It's a little bit over 1,000. It's a little over 1,200 people that are taken back. Now, that's the men. We're not given, the families are not numbered with them, so we don't know the total number. But by comparison, about 50,000 went back the first time. It's a much smaller group going back. But think about it. Why would a much smaller group be appropriate this time? Right. Right. And so it's not labor, right? We're not building something in that way. The idea this time is to go back. And are there already Levites there? Yeah, you remember? I mean, remember the first time that there were those who could not establish their lineage, and so they were not allowed to be among that number. And so there's already, it's not necessary. They're going to try to help the situation of people who are already there. This is not, we're bringing a bunch of people back to reestablish Jerusalem. We're bringing people back to set Jerusalem that's already there in order, religiously speaking. And so that's their goal. All right. So a smaller group, but with plenty as far as provisions, and more provisions promised when they get there, they head out. But before they do, they gather together to pray. And what is available to Ezra if he wants it? Additionally from the king. Protection. Yeah. He could go down there with the military force of Persia if he wants it. But why doesn't he ask for it? The hand of God is with us. He will protect us. Also, could you send us about 50,000 forces so that people don't steal our stuff? So he doesn't want to make that claim. He doesn't want to make his God seem small in the king's eyes. Now, I just would point out that Ezra is going, I believe, with more knowledge of God's favor and God's hand on his side than maybe we generally would have. I think sometimes people can be very foolish like this. They can take this approach of Ezra here in questions of, for instance, healthcare. You know, I'm not going to the doctor. I believe in God. Yes. God provided the doctors, right? You know, you don't just ignore God's provisions. But I think there are moments, especially in Scripture, where God has promised certain things, and men and women who have those specific promises go forth standing on those promises. Don't then take that and say, me without specific promises, I should rely on things God has not promised. And use the benefits that God has given us, the blessings that God has given us. And so this was an appropriate thing. That doesn't mean that's always the appropriate way to handle whether or not to take advantage or make usage of the opportunities, the blessings that are around us. Incidentally, on the first journey, they sure did use, you know, the government's help, you might say, in a number of different ways. And so they're not discarding it and saying, we want nothing to do with you, like Zerubbabel said to the Samaritans. They're willing to have an amiable relationship with the government. What he's saying here is God has promised to protect us. We're going to believe him in this instance. All right. So when Ezra arrives in Jerusalem, what is the biggest problem that he finds there, the main problem to be addressed? Okay, intermarriage with foreign wives, pagan wives. And particularly, I would say pagan is the best way to describe it, because the problem is not interracial marriages. Okay, the problem is interreligious marriages, where God has called his people to follow him and him alone, and they are marrying other people who do not follow God. That's the problem. How do we know that God is not, doesn't have that same wrath towards interracial, or between the marriages of Israel and other nations? Ruth and Boaz comes to mind. Who else? Even earlier.
Rahab.
Moses. Yeah. It's not racial purity. And I think sometimes people come to the scriptures and they think that this is sort of, proof that the Bible was written back when racism was sort of okay, if you could say that, or something like that. And that God, you know, he's genocidal and Jew supremacist, not white supremacist, but he's Jew supremacist. It's not true. It's not true. The issue, we just said, people were coming to Judaism there in Susa, back where Mordecai is. That's not the problem. The problem is these people aren't coming to follow God. They are bringing their household idols. They're bringing their idolatry with them. They have not left that and become Jews. They remain loyal to whatever gods that they came from. And so that's what must be cut off. As we look at what Ezra does when he sees that, first of all, how did he react? I mean, what is his what is his thoughts on that? And so it's a display, you know, and it's a display that we see and among a lot of prophets. It's a kind of display. It's very demonstrable, you know, very visual, and it's meant to get attention, not in a bad way. I mean, you know, in an appropriate way, meant to grab attention in the way that says this is horrible. This is how horrible I think this is. And so here's a person who comes back with zeal, and he's going to come back and he's going to teach the law, and he walks in the door and it's, oh my word. Look at where things are. Look at how bad things have gotten, where you've utterly disregarded the law concerning this. You've tangled yourself up in a way that, how are we going to straighten this out? And so there's frustration, and there's sorrow. There's righteous indignation. And so he, in his distress, he offers a prayer, and it's a confession of failure on the part of God's people. And it's abject failure. And so he's very pointed and very strong in his language. And when he does this, when he has this physical reaction and then he has this prayer, how do the people respond to that? And essentially, you're exactly right, and we are wrong. And so, again, what we're getting is some favorable responses. And in the return, there's a lot more hopefulness in the responses of the people than we had earlier among any of the prophets. You know, all through the decline of the kingdom, there's just seems to be no response. Here, it's just not the case. So Ezra comes in, and they are responsive. And they do join him in the mourning of these things, the sorrowing over these things. And so, what do they call for? What do they send out? They send out a message throughout Judea and tell the people to do something. Anybody who doesn't will do what will thoroughly what will happen to them? Right. Yeah. So what will happen is they'll lose all their property. And then they will be cut off from the assembly. They won't be part of the nation anymore. 3 days to get to Jerusalem. They mean business. And so come to this assembly or else. Well, they do come to the assembly. And when they get there, What's the weather like? It's not a question you ask often in Bible class, but what? Yeah, it's lots of rain, and this would have been about October, November, or November, December, somewhere around in that area. It's towards the end of the year, or the fall of the year, rather. And so lots of rain. It would have been cold outside, and Ezra, in the midst of that, makes a speech to the people, and it's an impassioned plea for them to reconcile before God and to make right the wrongs that they have committed. And so, can you just imagine that? I mean, the driving rain, and he got to be screaming out through that rain. But how do the people respond? Again, they're struck. Their consciences are pricked. They really are responsive to what he's saying. However, there are some people who have a thought about this. And what's that thought about how this should be managed?
Responsible.
Right. Right. And so he says this is not the work of a few days or of a couple of days. And so they're out there in the rain, and we can't just sit out here in the rain for however long this takes. So the solution that is suggested is each man who has married a foreign wife make an appointment, and then they come and each in his turn go through the process of reconciling their particular situation. All right. So how do the people respond to that? How does Ezra respond to that? Any objections? There were some objections. On what basis were the objections? They opposed. Well, I think there are some people that said, let's stay right now. We're not going to go home. There were some people who were even more zealous than the people who said, let's break this up. And then there are some who may be opposed, but there are those who are even more adamant that this should be handled now. Well, they do send them home. They do make their appointments. And they begin to go through the process. And what is the process? What's the solution to these wives? Yeah. Yeah. Right. Let me see here. Yeah. Well, that's my understanding of that. That they objected to because what we've seen is no objection to Ezra's call so far. And then we've got an objection to handling it this way. And then we've got a suggestion to handle it this way, and everybody's on board except these guys are opposed to this. What are they opposed to? It seems to me they're opposed to the making of the appointments and the sending the home. And my point would be is that there's nobody, it seems, no discernible objection in the other direction of let's just not worry about it. In other words, what you got is zeal, and you got even more zeal. And to the whole thing. Yeah. Right. Right. They would have been among those whose property is seized or whatever, right? I mean, well, at any rate, they do make their appointments. And so one by one they come, and what's the solution? I mean, how do we resolve this?
Yeah. You have children.
Right. And that takes time. I wonder if the taking of time involves the potential that they've got to look at a case by case basis. Why might they need to look at a case by case basis? They're not the same. What could be different? Maybe there's some proselytes among those. There are those who have renounced whatever gods and that they do serve the one true God. That wouldn't be a problem, you see. So it's not just if your wife is from over there, get rid of her. No, if your wife loves other gods, she's got to go. That's the issue. And so you got to work through that. And how long does it take them to work through that? It takes them 3 months to work through that. And I would just say about that sometimes we get tangled up in sin in such a way that even when we go about repenting, sometimes it's going to take time to clear up all the mess that we've made. And that's what happens here. It takes some time to clean up the mess. It's not just take care of it. No, let's work through this. Let's do what's appropriate and kind of go through that in an orderly fashion. So they do that. What precedent does that set with regards to what God thinks of marriage? What does God think of divorce? He hates it. What does this say about that? There are things he hates worse than divorce. Okay, and my point would be that there, what we have with God is sometimes we have things where God says, I hate this, but I hate this worse. And there are some people who would put the I hate divorce at the top. This story says, no, that doesn't go at the top. And if God wants these people to dissolve these marriages, to divorce in these cases, it means that God is willing that there are some things that are worse than divorce. And it is, in this case, these marriages that are unrighteous. And I make that point because I think it's an important point as we move over into the New Testament. And we have a definition for what's an unrighteous marriage. And there are people who will go back to Malachi and they'll hold up as God's highest priority. God hates divorce. But right here, I can show you there's something he hates worse. Now, incidentally, I was reading recently, there's a fellow, a Christian, who's taken the book of Ezra and tries to show how Ezra misinterpreted the law and got all this wrong. And what he was requiring the people to do was not what God would have required of them. I want to suggest to you that what he's doing in that case is he's saying that since there is no explicit approval spoken by God in this book, that we have to go back and we have to investigate. And if we can't find the direct command that Ezra is carrying out here, then we just have to assume Ezra's wrong. I'll tell you, that's a very dangerous precedent. That's not how we approach the Bible, that when God's messengers are doing something, unless we have some reason to believe otherwise, they're doing so with approval. And so I think we need to be very careful about trying to discount something like that. It's set there for a reason, for lessons to be learned. Brad?
Same problem?
Yes.
And doesn't he take the same approach?
He got it wrong too.
And is that what he said?
Yeah.
So it's part of the problem, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. What he would say is, look, it just sometimes we just get it wrong. Ezra's a good guy, but he got it wrong. Right. That's my answer to that. Indeed, sometimes we get it wrong. All right. Well, we'll pick up on Nehemiah on Sunday with the return and the rebuilding of the wall. Appreciate your attention.